Hello and welcome to the Word of Webb podcast. I'm Eric. I'm here with Reverend Dr. Richard Webb.
Hi there.
In this show, we get a chance to nerd out on a variety of biblical topics with Pastor Richard.
We tend to go all over the place.
And we have a special guest in the show today. You probably noticed that from the title of this episode. But before we get to that, I want to thank you for tuning into this episode and would like to ask you a quick favor. Our mission at Here at Hope is to reach out to the world around us and share the everlasting love of Jesus Christ. So if you could take a second to rate and review the show and maybe send it to a friend, that's one thing you can do to help reach more people. Also, if you ever have any questions for Richard or topics you'd like to hear discussed on the show, you can submit those by clicking the link in the description. That's linktree.com/wordwithweb. So we've got special guest Colette Nelson in the studio today. So welcome, Colette.
Hello, hello.
And she is a minister and care team lead here at Lutheran Church of Hope. Can you tell us what that means?
It means I'm unbelievably blessed. I lead a team that basically is front lines for anybody in crisis or transition. So we usually are the people that someone meets with when they come in the office and are in need. And so I oversee also all the support groups, the funerals, all that good stuff.
And how long have you been doing this?
Almost 20 years.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
You're a veteran.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Or old, whichever way you want to say it.
Yeah. Veteran.
Well, we've got Colette in for this topic because we thought it would be a great perspective, and you have a lot of experience in what we're calling this episode is Light in the Darkness, part of our Advent series. So, I thought we'd just kind of jump right in because we got a lot of stuff to cover, but just start by defining what does light in the darkness mean and why would we title this episode that? Do you want to start, Colette?
Yeah, I can. That's an interesting question. And also, you know, just this week talking to so many people after Thanksgiving and as we approach the holidays, not only is the weather and the mood darker because of, you know, darker, quicker during the day, but also then the pressure to live up to all the other expectations that the world has for us in regard to what the holiday should be. But then most importantly, Mike said in a sermon, you know, it's all about the waiting. And in the waiting also, it can feel pretty dark. Mm-hmm. And so having light at the end of the tunnel, or having something to look forward to, is really, really important, especially this time of year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have anything to add to that, Richard? Why is this important to specifically the Advent season and not anything else? Mm-hmm. And just why is it just an important topic in general that we needed to hit during Advent?
Man, there's all kinds of ways in. One is just light and darkness are major biblical themes. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting. We discover the character of God very early. What does God do with darkness? Well, darkness is also a symbol for chaos. So, you know, so what does God do? He shines his light on it and redeems it. And in Genesis 1 and chapter 1, the light shines in the darkness, and he calls it day. In other words, he makes time out of it. Hmm. And so God is in the redemption business of things we think are unredeemable, like darkness.
Amen.
Yeah. You know, and so we even get, like in Psalm 23, is even though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, or other translations, I walk into the deepest, darkest valley, I won't be afraid because you're with me. So we learn that God has the capability not only to rescue us from the darkness, but also in the darkness. You get this again in John's Gospel, the chapter 1, which imitates Genesis 1, in the beginning, what's the Word, and the Word was with God. And then he begins to refer to the Word as the light of all people. He says, the light shone in the darkness, and then there's this word that goes two different ways. It says, and the darkness couldn't comprehend it. Words couldn't make any sense out of it. And then if you keep reading the Jesus story, the powers that be can't make any sense out of it. And they turn out to be the powers of darkness who killed Jesus. The other one, though, and this is the hope symbol, is the light shines in the darkness and the darkness can't overcome it. Mm-hmm. And so we discover that God is the one who not only does he have victory over the darkness, but he can actually leverage the darkness itself for our benefit. You know, which means he has this wonderfully creative grace that whatever you're going through, it never gets the last word, even though he might come in sideways where you just don't expect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good.
So Colette, do you see that during this Advent season, like there's more people who are experiencing darkness and this chaos, like Richard said, or is it just something that we maybe notice more because we feel like it shouldn't be happening this time of year?
I think it's a little bit of both. I do think it's increased during this time of year, a lot for the reasons I mentioned. People come off holidays or enter into holidays thinking it's supposed to be this beautiful, magical thing. And oftentimes, because of family of origin or the way they're feeling, depression, anxiety, things like that, it falls short a little bit. So mm-hmm. it does feel like it is increased during Advent, which also is why it's even more important to focus on the reason for Advent to get us through that darkness, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this is, everyone calls this, you know, the most wonderful time of the year. So when people are going through darkness, I think a lot of times they think, why then do I feel this way if this is supposed to be the most wonderful time of the year? And how would you respond to that when people are saying, well, this isn't normal, or is this normal for me to experience this? We'll just start there. What would you say to someone who's asking that question?
Well, first of all, I like to remind people that actually, if they had any idea how many other people felt the way they feel. So a lot of us sit in church on a Sunday and think everybody else has got it all figured out, and they're joyful and they're sending out these great family photos, but that's not the norm, actually. And so a lot of it is just helping people understand, meeting them where they're at and validating how they're feeling and reminding them that this side of heaven, we're going to struggle, and they're not alone in their struggle. It's actually pretty common. But the cool thing is we can point each other to the solutions for the struggle or ways to get through the struggle.
Yeah.
And so what are some of those things that they can use to get through a struggle during the Advent season?
Yeah, well, we're here. we're here via phone, via email. You can walk into the building. And so part of our role is just to love people right where they're at. Mm-hmm. And I know the holidays are hard for me. And so I can empathize with those that find this time hard. We also have a tremendous amount of support groups. Mm-hmm. We have grief support groups and divorce support groups, but we also have, you know, Celebrate Recovery, which a lot of people think is just for addiction, but it really is for hurts, habits, and hangups. And so I always tell people, if you have a pulse, you belong there, because we all have something going on. And so it's another place, too, I think, to find community, because that's a big part of the struggle. When I'm sitting across from someone, and almost 100% of the time when I ask the question, are you connected? Are you in community? The answer is no. And so a lot of it is just getting people into community. And at Hope this time of year, there are so many things, not even just support-wise, but be a greeter for a Christmas service, and all of a sudden you're surrounded by other people, and it kind of lightens the load a little.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, that's a really important thing, because I found in my own life that one of the keys for loneliness is to go serve.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's even science behind this. When you stop thinking about yourself, you feel better.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so isolation, the only thing you think about is yourself.
Yes.
You know. When I think about it also, I'm just thinking also theologically about all of this. And, you know, you said the most wonderful time of the year. When I think what the biblical authors say is it was the most awful time of the year. I mean, you know, Caesar had an ego, and he decided he was going to send everybody back to their hometown to get taxed. I mean, that must have been a massively disruptive thing for the whole empire. Because everybody, you know, across this gigantic Roman Empire was going to have to go back to wherever they came from. Some people might be working and living now in Alexandria, Egypt, but they might have been born in Italy. You know, and now, you know, Mary and Joseph, you know, it's about a 3 days journey, you know, and then they can't find a Holiday Inn and they wind up in a garage, you know, and the kid gets born in an icky, gross feed trough. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and this is where our going back to the biblical story can reground us.
Yeah.
That Christmas happened in darkness, not just at night, but in the darkness of the Roman Empire, in the darkness of being homeless, you know, in the darkness of dirt and unsanitary conditions where Mary is wondering if her kid's going to survive, you know, of two scared teenagers, you know, and then the first people to show up would be the equivalent of a street gang. I mean, this is not warm and fuzzy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so just actually going back to why is this here? This is like, I think a parallel is just what we came out of Thanksgiving. You know, it's again, everybody's supposed to be happy, family time, let's have the big turkey. A lot of families have chosen to actually go serve turkey,
mm-hmm.
or to make meals, and that actually, and they do it with other people, and that's how they deal with not having their expectations of the perfect holiday crashed. And so, you know, a little bit of the theme is whether you're greeting people on Christmas Eve or you're serving turkey at Hope Ministries, which is a homeless shelter here in Des Moines,
yeah.
Your focus is on something else other than yourself. And I don't think you're ever disappointed when you're serving other people.
Absolutely not. It's like you said, it's the best prescription to get you out of your own head and into serving and thinking about somebody else. I also, it makes me curious when you kind of grounded us back to the origins of everything. Mm-hmm. You have to wonder, it must have been who made the decision to call it the most wonderful time of the year then? marketing. Marketing.
Exactly. In other words, back in the 40s, there was some department store, you know, that wanted to come up with a slogan so they could sell more stuff.
Yeah.
That and Norman Rockwell in his paintings.
Yeah. And again, from a society standpoint, it is now a consumer holiday.
Yes.
Where, you know, a week before Halloween, we suddenly see Christmas trees in the local Costco, you know, and right next to the masks of ghouls and ghosts and witches, mm-hmm. you know, and the next thing you know, the day after Halloween, you know, December 30, well, it'd be November 1st, we now have Christmas music everywhere, mm-hmm. you know, and so just forget the fact that it's this capitalistic, you know, buy fest,
mm-hmm.
Just that makes it all about me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It absolutely
just
does.
Just that fast.
Yep.
Okay, so I want to go back a little bit to what you were saying about being grounded in the story then.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Do you ever notice, well, here's just where my mind's going. If we get grounded in the story of the Bible, we know how things end, mm-hmm. right? We know that things get better. We don't know when. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you're in like a season of sorrow or darkness, when you have someone say like, oh, someone, it'll get better,
mm-hmm.
that's not helpful.
No.
Exactly.
But also the not knowing when it's going to get better
mm-hmm.
is not helpful. is kind of weird. I remember when my dad died, we were told that it was basically a 2-year grieving process,
mm-hmm.
which seemed like a long time, but also it felt like, oh, there's a finish line.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I understand being grounded in the story and mm-hmm. that, yes, yeah. God prevails. But also, do people ever not like that answer?
Absolutely,
right?
They don't.
And so what,
I didn't.
So there's you mm-hmm. can serve, you can be in community. Is there uh-huh. anything else? What would be your response to someone who's like, I know God wins, but it's still not fun right now, and I don't know when the not fun's going to end.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think the unknown in that is hard. And I remember when my parents died, I found somebody here at Hope that had made it. I don't know if you ever get to the other side of grief, but made it to the other side of their situation. And I said, how did you do that? That's, again, why Christian brothers and sisters are good, because they can give us hope and like, oh, this does come to an end, or mm-hmm. not an end. It just morphs. It just changes.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, again, in that situation, whether it's yourself or whether it's someone you know that's going through grief, for instance, during the holidays, validating just how they feel. And I think sometimes we get stuck in the place where we think we have to have answers. We think we have to fix it. And really what they need is our quiet presence. And that's what I needed. I think it's kind of like Jesus with skin on, you know, just a quiet presence to be in that space. But also for someone in my situation, grew up as a Christian, knew everything I needed to know about being a Christian. But when the rubber hit the road in my own darkness, I forgot everything I ever was taught about how graceful and loving God was. Totally went out the window. And so again, brothers and sisters in Christ came around me, could remind me, point me back to the stories of the Bible, could show the consistency of God and his presence in the lives of the people in the Bible and the lives. Like, you don't have to look too long to find pretty consistent reminders that God is in the darkness. And like Richard said, not only in it, but we'll make good out of it. We'll enter into it with you. And so there is nothing that we can say that makes it magically better. But our presence is really, really important. And then knowing that sometimes even Christians forget how good God is in their darkness. And and then we can be that for them. Mm-hmm. We can help them remember.
Yeah. Well, and the Psalms help us be okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we don't think it's okay to feel despairing or okay to wonder if there's ever an end to this. And just a real concrete example is if you have a chronic illness, by definition, we don't know when it's going to end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so how do you offer hope when from a medical standpoint, there is no end and this is your life?
Mm-hmm.
And so again, when I think of the Psalm 13 and Psalm 22 are two that come to mind. There's a whole genre of psalms called the complaint psalms or the lament psalms, or as one theologian calls them, psalms of protest, where we start wrestling with God. In fact, the name Israel literally means those who wrestle with God, and also those with whom God wrestles. So interesting that God would name his people one gigantic wrestling match. You know, that what's going to be characteristic of God's people is tussling.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and in Christian tradition, we've forgotten that, and so we think it's a sin to tussle with God. And yet, 2/3 of the Psalms are these protest psalms. I'm looking at Psalm 13; it's one of the shorter ones, and you know, you can just hear it. Oh God, how long will you forget me? Forever? How long will you look the other way? I mean, this is questioning God's faithfulness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how long must I struggle with anguish in my soul, with sorrow in my heart every day? How long will my enemy have the upper hand? And it almost sounds like the enemy in this case is depression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then turn and answer me, O God, restore the sparkle to my eyes or I will die. Don't let my enemies gloat, saying, we have defeated him. Don't let them rejoice at my downfall. And so, you know, this is not the rawest of psalms. Psalm 22 almost gets into rage. And there's even a psalm of hatred that was probably written during the Babylonian captivity. And it's kind of shocking. But it's sort of like you can get your emotions out in front of God.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's an act of respect that you trust him enough with your anger even towards him.
Yeah.
Do you trust that he's big boy and he can handle it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's interesting in this is often these psalms will end with some kind of rejoicing or trust. This one, and it's not that everything got all better, but the very act of getting it out begins to create a little light on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And so this one ends with, but I trust in your unfailing love. I will rejoice because you have rescued me, and I will sing to the Lord because he is good to me. And often the hope is expressed in the past tense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have confidence that it will happen so much, I'm going to say it's happened already.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens in the conversation with God in asking, come on, I love in Psalm 22 where, you know, my ancestors trusted you and you delivered them, but apparently I'm not worth your time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just a worm. I guess I'm just not significant. You know, and it's just downright sarcastic.
Mm-hmm.
So I found when I got sick, for goodness gracious, it was a couple of years, and you know, things would get better and then they wouldn't. And so there was a whole lot of, oh, no, not again. Mm-hmm. And one of those I got particularly ticked off. and I wrote a letter to God full of F-bombs. Yeah. You know, this good Lutheran pastor boy was cussing. But that had to come out. And he knew it was there already. So it was an act of respect that I finally got honest. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it was things like that that began to move towards healing. Mm-hmm. Again, none of this is magic bullets. It's all part of a process, just like friends. I cannot say enough to my friends who walked with me during that time, and many of them would just literally take a walk with me. Mm-hmm. Not much being said, but just being with.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, Colette, do you see practically, like, the people who maybe as they're healing in their darkness, they either resist what he's talking about, like getting it out and being angry with God, like, or do you see, what are you seeing actually, like, in the lives of people who are experiencing grief and sorrow and depression and in this time, as far as how they're able to get it out and how that helps them heal through that?
Well, I think I can speak too from my own experience. When my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer and then she ultimately lost the battle to that, I felt, as a good Christian at that time, that I just needed to be okay with the fact that that was God's will. Mm. And so I didn't feel like I could be angry. I didn't feel like I could even question. I was just supposed to be okay with it. And actually, that turned into a nice little episode of panic attacks for a while, because I wasn't letting it out and I wasn't allowing myself to feel what I felt. And so I do think it can go one of two ways, and it can either draw you closer or push you away. But so many people always told me that God knows your heart anyway. He knows what you're feeling anyway. So whether or not I speak it or don't speak it, if we feel like we're protecting God somehow by not, like, offending him and saying, I'm really angry that this happened, he knows that we feel like that anyway, but it's really a healthy place for us to get it out and process. So, yes, that's why things like support groups, grief share, divorce care, that's why you see numbers fairly high, you know, 150 people a week at Celebrate Recovery. All of those things work to help people find healing because you're processing, because you're able to be honest and lament. And it's a safe place to lament. It's and like you said, the first place I just jumped to the Psalms in my darkness and was like, okay, they gave us permission. There's words right here in front of us. And so I think for the most part, myself and a lot of people that I meet with fight that initially, fight the getting it out.
Being honest.
I just want to get through this or get over it. And we're taught in this life that everything is so microwave and fast food. And like you said, grief was supposed to be a 2-year process or whatever. There are people that will come into a grief share class and they'll go, okay, it's a 13-week class. So you're telling me if I do each week's homework and I get to week 13 that I will be done grieving. Mm-hmm. And it's the world we live in, because we're taught that you get 3 days of bereavement leave, or, you know, and you're supposed to be back to work and everything's supposed to be great. But the reality is it is a process. It's part of a journey. It's what brought me to Christ in a more beautiful and impactful way. And everybody's different. But for the most part, I would think human nature, and as Christians, a lot of times we fight against actually being honest about how we're feeling. But when we can get there, that's where the healing happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd also say, and especially with when things are like grief or chronic illnesses, people say, why is this? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the most honest and probably most sophisticated answer you can give is, I don't know. And again, we get from the book of Job, Job's three friends are great for the first 7 days, and then they get stupid and try to explain it.
Yeah, because there is nothing.
No.
The side of heaven that can explain some of the things that people face, for sure.
Yeah, so maybe I want to get into that those questions a little bit. How would you respond to someone who says, you know, as a Christian, I shouldn't feel this way? Am I doing something wrong, or is God punishing me, or maybe not even listening to me? Because I kind of was thinking about Job and how they're trying to explain it away. That's kind of maybe some ways that we self-explain it away. How would you respond to some of those questions and to someone who's struggling with darkness?
I'll go ahead and take a stab. Some very smart people have observed that when you try to explain this stuff, you have basically three options. And one has to do with the goodness of God and the justice of God. Another has to do with the power of God. And the other has to do with what we deserve. So if I smoke two packs of cigarettes a day, God is all just, God is all good, and I dug my own hole. Right? You know, no one's shocked if I was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer at age 60 if I've been smoking ever since I'm 18. Is it bad? Is it sad? Yes, but there's no mystery, right? Now, let's flip it around. Some three-year-old gets hit by a drunk. The drunk gets away with it because no one can find him, and he's been just ripped out of the arms of his parents. Okay, how does this work now with those explanations? Okay, did the kid deserve it? Nope. And neither did his loved ones, because there's a lot of people racked in deep pain. Okay, so is God good and just? Well, if you want to keep that, then he must not be all-powerful. And so we have a nice God who might wring his hands with you, but he can't do anything about it. Or if God's all-powerful, then the question is, why didn't he do anything about it? Which means maybe he's not good. And so we wind up with a set of really bad options every time we start explaining this. Some, either it's at God's expense or our expense. And, you know, and either way, these are not hopeful ways to talk. This is why Martin Luther said it's an act of faith to lay the devil at God's doorstep. If God is God, then you can ask him the really tough questions that Colette alluded to as well. And so I don't know, I think then we can say, but I think I know where you can take it.
Absolutely.
And then we're in the process of sometimes pounding against God's chest, you know, screaming at him, sometimes screaming at him and grabbing him and hanging on for dear life all at once, you know, and this is this complicated process of grief. And then those of us who are with that person, the best thing we can do is to take our cues from them on what's helpful.
Yeah. And sometimes we don't, all those tough questions we don't get an answer to, because isn't at the end of Job, that's kind of what God says is like, I'm not giving you an answer.
Yeah, it's kind of above your pay grade, Joe, you know, which is so utterly unsatisfying.
Well, yeah, and in Grief Share, part of the curriculum there, when I used to teach it, we spent a lot of time on the, because there's a natural part of grief that is asking the why. And people can get stuck in the why. And so moving through the grief process, you move from asking why to what is God going to do with it? What now? Rather than the why. So we work through after we've wrestled with God on the whys and not gotten the answers that we want, because ultimately there's no reason that anyone could give a why that would make it okay that your loved one is gone. There just isn't. And so moving through as a healthy part of grief to then start asking the question, what is God going to do with this? And then leaning in to that.
Yeah. And again, we have all kinds of resources in Scripture. You know, often what God does with it is other people.
Absolutely.
I'd say probably the most concrete response God gives is he begins to bring friends in, and then he flows through them to us. And if I'm in grief or illness or in pain, I'm not thinking theologically of, oh, this is God's presence in another. But I am experiencing the impact nonetheless. And this is the crazy thing. When a person has been well-resourced and they've been able to pass through the pain and not get stuck in it, something weird happens is often I had them come to me and say, I've seen God's hand all the way through this. And I wouldn't dare say that to someone because it would just trivialize them. But when they bear witness to their experience,
they have to discover it.
Yeah. Yep. And it's so powerful for me to hear that in something that has no good answers, they've sensed the power of God in it, and their friendship with God gets deeper, and their trust with God gets deeper in a situation that one would rationally conclude you would write God off.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've talked about some examples in the Bible, like in the Psalms and and in Job. Are there any other examples you can think of places where people have experienced deep sorrow or grief in the midst of joyful situations or celebrations or joyous occasions? Because we've talked a lot in this podcast about the different Jewish celebrations throughout the year. There were a lot of them.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing there were a lot of times that people felt like they should be celebrating, but they didn't.
Two come to mind. The first one is in 1 Samuel, right at the beginning with Hannah, is that her husband would get the whole clan together, and that included, he had two wives, Hannah and Peninnah, and they would go to a priest at Shiloh, and they would sacrifice, and then they would sit down to feast. And every year that reminded her that she couldn't have kids. And it's very interesting because the dialogue with her husband shows that he's not very, shall we say, situationally aware. He just says, "What's the matter? Aren't I worth more than seven kids to you?" You know, it's like, really? Seriously? But in the middle of, she's in such grief because this would be a time of rejoicing of God's generosity and bounty, and she's barren. And she's also, the other wife is an antagonist, you know, because probably Hannah's the primary wife. But if she can't have kids, then Peninnah will probably shift to being the primary wife. And that has to do a lot with inheritance rights and just your own security. And so she could lose status with her husband no matter what he's saying at the time. That potential is always there. So every time they go to sacrifice, it's one more year that God has not been generous to her. Well, everybody else is celebrating the generosity that God has given them, and like harvest and things like that. The other would be Passover at the time of Jesus. This is supposed to be a celebration of freedom from slavery, and then freedom into the land, and obviously this would include during the exile too. So if I'm in exile in Babylon or later Persia or later Rome is running everything, then the Passover almost feels like a mockery. Here we're celebrating freedom, but there's nothing free about it. And so, you know, we might say next year in Jerusalem, you know, and we might, you know, say that ritually, but you may be saying, yeah, we said that before a lot. And so I could see that the Passover was probably very bittersweet for people, you know, in the first century.
So Colette, talk to me a little bit more about like the process of that people can typically expect to go through in grief or depression or grief or sorrow. And two things that kind of come to mind that I want to ask you about is guilt or shame around that feeling. Is that ever part of that process of healing? And do you see that in people that they feel guilty for feeling this way or ashamed that they're feeling this way? Or like, what does that look like and how, what would you respond to that?
Yeah. So Kubler-Ross years ago wrote what she believed was the process of grief, which was very step by step. But what we know now is that it's more like, you know, those rubber band balls that the rubber bands are all tied around and they make a ball and whatever. It's more like that because grief for sure is one of those spaces where you can feel simultaneously two different emotions. And I'll give you an example. I felt relief and thankfulness that my mom didn't have to suffer anymore. And then right next to that was guilt, because why in the world would I feel relief that my mom had died? And so when you see people in the grief process, oftentimes we tell people that in any given day, in any given moment, you can feel contrary things at the same time. And I think helping people understand that as well, to realize that that's very normal, to feel good and to feel bad, to feel relief and feel guilt, and all of those things are part of the process, rather than believing that it's a step-by-step, and this is how a good Christian would grieve. Mm-hmm. because yeah. That's, I think, where we get stuck a lot in regard to, like, well, if I believed and I had faith and if I do believe that God is good, then all of this stuff, I shouldn't be questioning any of it. And I think, you know, the concept of realizing that emotions can be felt in all different extremes during the process is something that people need to be aware of. Mm-hmm. And that it helps. It validates you. Like, that was the best thing I got out of going to a group like Grief Share, was that, oh, my goodness, other people are feeling the same thing, that I'm not crazy. I'm not less Christian because I'm questioning. I'm not. So that's also what community, as we process through those things, is really mm-hmm. important.
Mm-hmm. That is so important, that grief is not a character flaw.
No.
And all the emotions associated with it are appropriate. And they're not signs of lack of faith. I mean, I think of grief like breaking an arm. Mm-hmm. Breaking an arm is not sinful.
Right.
It's just a broken arm. And it will take a while to heal. And sometimes it'll feel like, you know, it's getting all better. And then, you know, a week later, it starts hurting like crazy. You know, and you're wondering, well, why is it going backwards now, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I love that image of the ball, of just all this tangled rubber bands, mm-hmm. you know. And you see it at funerals, you know, where everybody is completely bawling their heads off in the service. And 5 minutes later, they're laughing their heads off during the meal. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, one will disengage after laughing and just sit down and start bawling their heads off again. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just bouncing all over the place.
Yeah.
And you see the praising in the midst of the sorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, the recognition that God is good, but they also mm-hmm. are still in sorrow.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
they go hand in hand. And yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, I remember at my dad's funeral, not crying. And shortly after, I went to another funeral of someone that I knew, and I remembered I cried during that one. Mm-hmm. And I was like, why couldn't I cry my own dad's funeral? But then this funeral, like, I can't keep it together. And feeling like, I think that feels wrong. For some reason,
it just
felt wrong. Mm-hmm. But what you're saying is, like, everyone's different, but, and like, whatever mm-hmm. your specific grieving process
yep.
is the correct mm-hmm. one.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would also say, too, just to name this, we've been talking a lot about grief in regard to death, but we, as a community, grieve a lot of things besides just death. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times you find people that feel guilty or shameful because they're carrying the weight of what feels like grief, but they've not officially had someone die in their life.
Mm-hmm.
So that may be a chronic illness, and they're grieving the things they can't do anymore, or that could be the loss of a job. Or during COVID, we saw just grieving the way the world was and those kinds of things. And so grief can come in different places. So just because you haven't had an actual death in your life mm-hmm. does not mean that you don't experience those same symptoms and same mm-hmm. things that mm-hmm. somebody else does with grief. Yeah. And so I find a lot of people are puzzled by that. They'll come in and I don't know why I feel this way. It doesn't make any sense. And it's like, what you're experiencing is grief.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why would I be grieving? I didn't have anybody die. And then you help them uncover and discover, like, oh, those are all losses. Those are all things that I'm saying goodbye to. So that's also.
Yeah. And I can also imagine and have felt before, like, a process where you feel mm-hmm. you mm-hmm. should be grieving, but you're like, well, I don't. My situation isn't as bad as that situation, so I shouldn't grieve because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I didn't lose someone.
Right.
At least I have these things,
mm-hmm.
And so you don't let yourself grieve because you think, well, I shouldn't grieve because it could be worse.
Yeah. We get in that place, I think, all the time. But I saw it even in Grief Share where, because it's an adult. It's adult-only class, but anybody who's lost anyone from anything can come. And so then you have the pockets of people that are there because an adult child died, or your pockets of people that are widows. And I always started out the class with that reminder that we're going to look at each other and we're going to say, they have it worse, or mm-hmm. I have it worse, because their loss is this and my loss is that. But the reality is, your loss is your loss. Mm-hmm. And it matters to you just as much as it matters to the next person. And so, there's no competition in the grief that we carry, for sure.
So what's the difference between then grief and depression?
Well, caveat, I'm not a licensed counselor, so I'm not going to diagnose anybody. but I would say I'm glad you brought up depression, too, because, again, we've talked a lot about grief. And depression can be part of the grief process. It typically is, to some extent. But depression on its own is something totally different. And obviously all of us at different seasons in our life have had periods of depression where we felt like we didn't want to get out of bed, or we had a heavy heart, or we just couldn't function or whatever. I think a lot of times what we look at in regard to that is if it's chronic, if it's not just – so for grief, as an example, when you have a depressive episode within grief, it's a normal part of grief. If that depressive episode lasts years, then it's moved on to depression. It's not, it's become chronic. And so they can be the same as far as it's part of the grief process to be depressed, but depression can sit off by itself. And I would say that the number of people that deal with some level of depression is unbelievable. I couldn't even quote you the number anymore because I think it's higher than what we say. You know, it used to be 1 in 4. Almost everybody I know has some level of depression or anxiety. Mm-hmm. And it's different too between, again, people that, I was depressed yesterday because I lost a race, you know, or whatever. That's different than a clinical depression that requires perhaps therapy, medication, mm-hmm. support, and those kinds of things. And so there's seasons, but then there's also clinical and chronic. Mm-hmm. And all of those are hard. And all of those also, though, what the things we've talked about are things that can help with that. Mm-hmm.
The other thing I think is important is there's so many causes for depression.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, all the way from genetics.
Yes.
To
chemical imbalance.
Yeah, trauma.
Trauma.
You know, so it's very, very important that it not be stigmatized. And like you said, the stuff that we were talking about with grief and sadness, those support things can be very helpful. I would say, it's very important to be aware of that, especially if you're working with people who are likely to have depressive episodes. But once again, this is something I've learned because, I'm not a licensed counselor either. So what's the most important thing to do is follow their lead.
Yeah, absolutely.
In some of my training, there's this crazy sentence that we were taught is help is not helpful unless it's perceived as helpful. Say that fast and it sounds goofy. Help is not helpful unless it's perceived as helpful. And so you always want to ask, is this helpful to you? Mm-hmm. Or sometimes, what's the best way I can be helpful? So that otherwise it's like, I know how to fix you, and boy, don't you feel better. Be grateful. What, you're not grateful? You don't feel better? What's the matter with you?
Well, it also can happen because we perceive what was helpful to us is going to be helpful to you or to the next person.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, when I was grieving or when I was depressed or whatever, this is what I found helpful. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily fit, and it's not about you at that point.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's meeting people where they're at. I think, I don't know if we'll get there anywhere else, so I'm just going to plug it in here. Mm-hmm. Another thing I would say, whether it's grief, depression, and any number of things. So one of the hardest things and one of the best things that someone can do is learn to ground themselves in the moment. Because I think a lot of things, whether any of those things, we get ahead of ourselves in the what ifs. Like, I can't imagine life without this person, or what if this happens, or there's all of the rumination that happens in what's to come and what life will be like down the road. And one of the best tools, and there's a million ways to do it, but one of the best tools is grounding yourself, grounding the person in the present moment. What do we know to be true about right here, right now? Because even biblically, I'm not going to be able to quote it, but, you know, God will take care of tomorrow, you know? Mm-hmm. And so for us to help people understand that all we have to get through is this moment right in front of us. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that is a lot easier than imagining a lifetime without someone. How about just getting through the moment without someone?
Yeah.
Not a lifetime without somebody, but one baby step at a time. And so grounding yourself in the present and leaning into God's word, his promises, his truth in that present moment is super, super helpful.
There's a quote that we've talked about, I believe, on the show before, Richard. It's a C.S. Lewis one. And I think it's in Screwtape Letters. So if you've read that book, it's kind of like opposite. So I can't quote it directly because it would come out weird. But it's basically that as a Christian, being grounded in the present and the eternal, whereas, and what he's saying is that the devil wants you to be focused on the past and the past and the future.
Yep.
And God wants you in the present and the eternal, those like four times, right? Mm-hmm. And so that sounds
so
like
true.
What you're saying, like, you can't change the past.
Nope.
And the future has not happened yet. So you can predict all these things, but we're also very bad at predicting the future. Mm-hmm. So you can often create these like extreme circumstances or situations that never actually
happen. That will probably never happen, and you've exerted all this energy and given yourself a panic attack in the process.
Pretty well. And boy, that is, I love the grounding yourself in the now and the eternal. Mm-hmm. Because the eternal, for someone who's following Jesus, is a hope-filled eternal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And also, by its nature of being eternal, you know, you think an average life is anywhere from, 70 to 100 years these days. Well, imagine one exercise is imagine yourself in heaven 49 million years from now. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, it would be a reasonable question to ask, what was all the fuss? You know, you know, but at the same time, it's the now, because God is not off there, over there, and he's right here. Whether it's the valley of the shadow of death, or it's the mountaintop of amazingness, you know, that that we have a promise that God walks with us, And that's the wild thing. The other thing that I've learned is that often healing is happening under our nose.
Absolutely.
And we often don't know what healing means. We have a very specific idea of what we think ought to happen. Mm-hmm. And then in hindsight, we begin to think, oh my gosh, there was God all over the place. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have the ability to perceive that. And that's okay. You don't have to. You know, we're not God. We're not going to get it all.
It's often hindsight, for sure.
Yeah,
in regard to that.
Yeah.
I remember we were praying for healing for my mom. And I even remember she was on the hospital floor at Methodist or whatever that was the cancer ward. And we had the nurses and everybody praying for healing, healing, healing. And after she died, I even found a prayer that she had written that said, heal me. And for a long time, I wrestled with that. But then at the same time, realizing that God did heal her, and I had to reframe what that looked like, and that God did it in the most beautiful and wonderful way that he could do that. Mm-hmm. It may not have been what I wanted it to look like,
but it was still
healing.
It probably would have been helpful for someone to say right after it happened, God did heal her. Mm-hmm. That probably wouldn't. You had to get there. On your own.
I had to get there on my own.
Oh, that is so important.
That was not prescribed by anyone else.
No. Yeah. There's a story that my seminary prof told our class. There was a senior at seminary who, at the beginning of the winter semester, approached him and said, I think I need to withdraw. And the prof was very surprised because this is one of his best students. And he says, well, why? He says, I don't think I'm fit to be a pastor. And he goes, well, tell me about it. Well, it turns out that their child, when they were at home during Christmas, the holidays, died of sudden infant death syndrome. Mm. I mean, and so in the middle of all this, they're having to prepare a funeral and a visitation. And while they're at the visitation with their little baby, you know, right next to them, a very well-meaning but horribly misguided pastor comes up to them and says, puts his hand on his shoulder and says in comforting tones, it was God's will. Mm. And this guy, without even thinking, turned around and decked him.
Oh,
yeah, you know, just
he did what most of us would want to do.
Yeah, and he punched him in the nose and he knocked him unconscious, you know, and he was so ashamed. And my professor's response was, "Son, for that you get an A." And which I think actually curiously was that was his way of saying that's okay. Now I don't encourage assault and battery. But again, I think there's a big difference between telling people how they should feel and explaining it away and then listening to their testimony in hindsight. You know, and there's things that, you know, the closest I'll get to saying anything sometimes is this won't make any sense right now, but when you're ready, you can start having a good fight with God because right now they're numb.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what I've said is weird, but I said, I just want to just give you this resource and maybe in a few weeks, in a month, in a year, you may want to do this. And I just want you to know that somebody said it was okay. It's about as far as I'll go. I would say also, and this is more for preaching. This isn't something you'd say in the moment, again, because it can sound so trivial, but just our responsibility as teachers and preachers is to help people understand that when God comes back, everything that's gone wrong, your mom dying of cancer, even if, where we've dug our own holes, all that is going to be not only redeemed, restored. And here's the crazy thing. There's a doctrine in Christianity called the resurrection, where everybody is going to be put back together. But in a new, improved body. I mean, we won't just be floaty spirits for eternity. We will be now the human beings we've been created to be in the first place. And we will be in a creation that will be the way it's been created to be in the first place. And we will be doing profoundly meaningful work and play. And the best word I can use to describe it is the Hebrew word shalom, where everything will be fruitful and flourishing and joyous and meaningful and significant, but in a light way, not a heavy way. And you know, the language in Revelation to describe that kind of joy is a big, huge wedding banquet that never ends. So as one, our Pastor Mike says, is the party starts, just get started, you know? So ain't no party like a Jesus party. And again, this is sort of like a seed that can be sown as a resource to call upon. So yeah, I remember hearing this, you know, that you know, or in one of the Psalms says, grief may be in the night, but then the morning comes, you know? And again, my guess is whoever wrote that had been through that, you know?
For sure.
So let's get a little bit into like loneliness and isolation. What is that role in grief, but also like, is there a difference between loneliness and being alone, and how does isolation play in the grieving process? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I can be in a room surrounded by people, so I'm not technically alone, but I'm lonely in that space because of what I'm dealing with, perhaps. So when you think of, you know, think of that, it is definitely different being alone and being lonely, and how those things enter in. I think whether it's the grief process or whether it's something like a diagnosable depression, a lot of times those things are very isolating just in the nature of what they are. And as far as, for instance, I had friends that didn't know what to do with me. And it wasn't because they were bad people or didn't care. They just did not know. And they had never lost a parent. I was young. And so by the very nature of that, they pulled back. because they didn't know what to do with me. And so that happens all the time in whether somebody's dealing with a chronic mental illness, somebody's dealing with grief or whatever. Mm. It is not because we don't care. It is usually from a place of helplessness that we, one, don't understand it, and two, don't know what to do with it. And so it tends to isolate people. So then they're, you know, or like my dad in that situation, he found himself, you know, they had a whole bunch of couple friends. And then when my mom died, all of a sudden he was the extra. And so he felt weird and he started not going to things, or they stopped inviting him. And so all of those things can be very, very isolating. And so I think it's counter when we're in it for us to seek out the support, you know, to seek out those things that are really healthy. It's easier for us to just also isolate and say, well, it's easier for me to just figure this out by myself, kind of thing. I don't know. What would you say, Richard, in regard to that?
Well, I think, and again, we talked about there's multiple ways that grief can happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, craziness, people sometimes experience grief right after a marriage. Mm-hmm. Not because the marriage is unhealthy or the spouse is bad, but because they're grieving the loss of autonomy. Suddenly they're responsible for each other. It's just a massive change. I mean, grief is sort of a human emotional response to any kind of major change. And I was just thinking of a way to describe it. I'm going to use just an automotive thing. Everybody else is in third gear and you're in second. So you're out of sync with everybody.
Hmm. Which is also very isolating.
Yeah, yeah. And so you could even be with a party with good friends that you know well, and yet you feel like you're the only one in the room. Because mm-hmm. your mind is probably focusing on the source of your grief. Mm-hmm. So you're doing all this problem solving, you know, mm-hmm. because it's part of grief is trying to fix it real fast.
Yep.
If I can just find the reason I feel this way, you know, and so, which means then your attention is not on what's going on in the room. You're not as self-aware as you'd normally be. So emotionally, you're not in the room.
Right.
And so that's where the isolation is not just physical, but also psychic.
Yes.
You know?
Yep.
And so, you know, and again, if you're ever going to go through grief, the best thing to be is part of a church with about 9 pastors and a gigantic pastoral care team. Because it's not their first rodeo. So you're less likely to be isolated. You can't control that. But I'm very grateful for the friends I have on this staff. And because there is that sense of, you know, we've been trained, you know, that you know, to know what, literally to learn it's okay not to do anything. Because mm-hmm. that means that we don't stand there feeling helpless and then back away. We can be present and not do anything.
Yeah.
Which that would be my one advice to anybody who's feeling helpless with someone who's going through grief is they don't need you to fix it.
Because you can't.
No, nope. And so they don't need you to say just the right thing. Because, again, you can't. They just need you to be there. And you can just ask them, what do you need right now? Mm-hmm. Or what would be most helpful? You can also ask them, what do you not need? Mm-hmm. In other words, let them tell you. And those aren't bad questions. In fact, they'll be welcome. Someone's listening to them. Mm-hmm. And that actually breaks down isolation because I am curious what they think. And questions often create bonds that you have no idea. When you listen to someone and you actively listen with, you know, with a question that shows that you actually want to know with, you know, when they hear curiosity, that can be incredibly healing all by itself. Someone's taking me seriously in this, you know, and just that may be the oasis that they just desperately need in the desert of their pain.
Well, mm-hmm. you created space for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is extremely validating.
So Colette, you mentioned this community that you experienced that didn't know what to do with you. I've experienced
they
that.
They still don't.
Yeah. but as we're talking about like community how you help someone in the grief mm-hmm. process, and you don't necessarily have to do anything, just listen and be mm-hmm. present. How is that different than being in a community that just doesn't know what to do with you and just kind of like doesn't do anything? You know what I mean? Like if our role is to like mm-hmm. not really not fix it, you don't have to mm-hmm. just to be present. Mm-hmm. How do those two things look different?
That's a really good question. And I'm going to noodle on that a second. The one thing that comes to mind is, for me at least, I feel like oftentimes when you're in that space, the friends, that it almost feels like you're a leper. Mm-hmm. Like you need to go to your own island and figure mm-hmm. your stuff out. Because I even had people that were like, let me know when you're happy again. Or, you know, like, and so it is just, it's almost the separation of, mm-hmm. rather than this being with. And so when you talk about what's the difference between the two things, it feels oftentimes like you're sent off to figure it out, to fix it, to get better, whatever that is. But in what we're called to and what we talk about is being present with people. You're not sending somebody off. You're sitting with them in it. You're not doing anything different. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you get sent off or whether you're having somebody sit with you, it's not that the person sitting with you is doing anything necessarily. It's just that they didn't send you away to go be mm-hmm. fixed, and that they're acknowledging that what you're going through is hard and they don't know what to do, but they're going to be with you in it, mm-hmm. if that mm-hmm. makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's so then you feel like you have, there's a partnership, there's a, mm-hmm. you know, you're mm-hmm. not in it alone. You've yeah. got somebody yeah. that can actually say, I don't know what to do with this, but I'm willing to sit through it with you, mm-hmm. is phenomenally different than feeling like you have to go somewhere to figure it out and then mm-hmm. come back yeah. when you're fixed.
There was I can think of two experiences that I've had, like, deep grief, and specifically during Advent. Mm-hmm. One time was shortly after losing my dad, and I remember going, having a community of friends invite me to go do something, mm-hmm. and not one of them asked me a question about how are you doing, just very simple things. Mm-hmm. They all just went about doing what the activity was, like mm-hmm. like it never happened. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure they wanted to distract my mind, mm-hmm. but like I just wanted someone to acknowledge what had just happened,
yep.
and not get my mind off of it. Mm-hmm. And then the other time was we had our youngest had a bunch of seizures, and actually one on Christmas Day and one on the day after Christmas. Mm-hmm. And someone on our staff had been through the exact same mm-hmm. situation. And had just reached out and asked how I was doing. Didn't share any further information, like, hey, but allowed me to get it out and almost like be the sounding board for my mm-hmm. anger and my grief. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in it, he was able to share his story, like, here's what happened to me, and let me tell you how it worked out. Mm-hmm. Like, not that he didn't say like everything's going to be okay. He just sat there and said like, I'm mad with you, mm-hmm. because you're going through
whiff.
That. Yeah,
that's mm-hmm. the difference. Yeah. It's a whiff, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And I think that's a beautiful example of how God uses our own stuff. Mm-hmm. Because this friend of yours, whoever reached out to you, obviously when they went through it was terrible. Mm-hmm. But God used that mm-hmm. In a way mm-hmm. that it was mm-hmm. able to bless you and help you through what you went through. And that's kind of the beautiful thing too.
Yeah.
There's this thing that we often read at the beginning of funerals. It's from 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 3. And it sort of summarizes what we're talking about. Paul is writing, he says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and the God of all consolation, who consoles us all in our affliction, so that we may be able to console those who are afflicted with the consolation with which we ourselves are consoled by God."
Yep.
And this is this thing where God redeems the darkness, mm-hmm. is...
Back to the beginning.
Yep.
That's exactly what you said.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. And so this like you said, this couple who went through the same thing you experienced was then, God kind of guided them. This is how I would see it behind the scenes, mm-hmm. To be present with you, because, you know, they were the expert in your situation.
Yeah.
Not that they had to say, I know just how you feel, because that's like... By the way, hot tip, never
say
that.
Don't say that.
Yeah.
But they were able at least to be present in it because they had some knowledge. Okay, yeah, this is not just plain weird to us.
What was interesting was we had doctors and medical professionals telling us basically the diagnosis of what our son, he's fine now. But at the time it was a big thing. And the doctors, he had his brain scan and all that sort of stuff. And the doctors would basically say like, he's probably going to be fine. And we've seen this all the time. It's going to be fine. That was not helpful.
No.
And they were the experts. But when it was Khalil, when Khalil said, when he was able to speak into it from his perspective, that helped.
Yes.
And and he wasn't a doctor. He just was there, present, and shared his story. And his story was able to be redeemed, I'm sure, one of many times.
Yeah.
Because he'd been through it, and he helped me get through it. So.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that, I don't know if you guys noticed, but they were recording at Hope 360 upstairs for the weekend. And that's another perfect example is the memorial tree that we have in our prayer garden. That was started 29 years ago by a woman who had lost her 2-year-old son. And out of that, she wanted to create a space where people could remember by hanging their ornaments. That was 29 years ago. Then fast forward to now, a lifetime later, there's a group of grieving moms here within the church that started a support group. And they actually wanted, as part of their process, to decorate the tree every year. Neither the person who started it or this group of women knew each other or anything like that. But now, like full circle God moment, they came together this year to do it together, and they met for the first time. And that's the hindsight thing where you can look at it and go, wow, what God did. And Patty could not have seen that 29 years ago when she was in the deep, dark depths of her own grief. And now what a beautiful blessing. And these now moms that are newer to their grief, that are being blessed by something that was started and planted through Patty's own process and her healing. And God was all over that.
Yeah.
All over that. So it's really pretty incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, this speaks of what I would say the power of healthy community. You know, is that when we lay down our need to fix and we're just present for others, I mean, God just flows.
Okay, so to kind of wrap things up here, I want to throw a couple questions out and just to kind of help people figure out maybe what their next step is. How does someone know when they need help? Where can they get help? And what is the church doing to help, or what can the church do to help?
Yeah, those are good questions. How to know when to get help? A lot of times we ourselves don't know that when we're in the midst. Oftentimes it's the truth tellers in our life that that tell us. But again, I think looking at chronic things, you know, when you need help, when, you know, it goes from instead of a couple days in bed in your pajamas, not showering, turns into weeks and months of that. When you're isolating, when you're not doing the things that used to bring you joy, when you're disconnecting from people, all of those things are definitely. And here's the thing: when we talk about when do you need to get help, that's an interesting phrase too. Because honestly, if we're doing life the way we're designed to do life, we're just living life with each other, and you're not reaching out to your church or whatever because you need help. You're in a stage of your life that you just need more community. So it isn't necessarily, I don't know if that makes sense, but it feels like it isn't a like, oh, I'm over here, I'm okay, everything's great. Oh, I'm broken, so now I need to go seek help. It really is about being in Christian community all the time. And so that we can ebb and flow with each other in life and the ups and downs. You talked about somebody, you know, in your life that has struggled or whatever. So we have those communities to ebb and flow and things like that. But if we don't, for whatever reason, a lot of those things like isolation and not finding joy in things, not eating, not sleeping, those kinds of things, as far as what we can do, our local church, I don't know what it speaks to around the world, but our local church here, that's what we're here for. We want to listen and be present in that space with you. And then our goal is to connect people to the best resources possible to help them. Mm. And that's different for everyone. And that might be resources within the walls of the church. It also might be resources outside of the walls of church. Mm-hmm. So we look at things like partnering somebody with a one-to-one prayer partner that can walk with them very intentionally through that season, or going to a support group such as grief share, divorce care, those kinds of things. But also, we have some really amazing Christian counselors in our community that we have built relationship with. We trust them. And so if that's needed, then we connect people that way too. So there, when you're in the midst of those processes and you're in your own darkness, you cannot usually find your way out of a bag.
Yeah.
Let alone like, oh, should I go to a counselor? Oh, how do I find a counselor? Oh, what kind of counselor do I need? All of those things. And so our hope is that we can meet you in whatever it is that you're dealing with, whether it's mental health or financial or, you know, death and dying, all of those things, and to be able to resource you. And it's not because we have all the answers, but we have really great connections in this community, and we are better together in that regard.
Mm-hmm. You know, something you said is often when you're in the middle of it, you are pretty brain dead.
Yes.
You know, and so one of the things I think we can do is create space where you can find your way to what you need, where you're not on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like you said, you started rattling off, well, what kind of counselor do I need? Well, there's about 40 different kinds. Yeah. And even when you're not depressed, you're going to have a hard time finding them.
Right.
You know, so we can help you unpack and notice for yourself what you're going through a little bit better. And then maybe you can make some choices without just feeling so thoroughly overwhelmed.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
That's
absolutely
good. Anything else you want to add, Richard or Colette, on this topic before we wrap things up?
I don't know. I think we got. What do you think, Colette?
I think we covered a lot.
Got it?
Yeah,
I think we did.
Absolutely.
Well, if this topic is something that you want to get some help on, or is there a way that people can reach out and get connected to the services here at Hope that you want to, I guess, plug? Would it be go to the website, or
you can go to the website, or our email is just care@hopewdm.org. Okay. Then we'll get you to the right people. I would also say just community-wise and United States-wise, et cetera, broader than us. Obviously, go to your local church. Mm-hmm. But 988 now is the number for people who are struggling to the point of feeling like they don't want to live or things like that, or if you just need somebody to talk to, 988 is also a really great resource. 'Cause we have our limits in regard to what we can do. And so a lot of times, even when we're not around, something like 988 might be a help as well.
Yeah. So. All right. Well, I think that's a good place to end. So thank you for joining us today. And as always, if you have a question on a previous topic or a suggestion for a future one, we would love to hear from you. And you can click that link in the description to submit those. That's linktree.com/wordwithweb. So we'll talk to you next time.
You bet. See you next time.